reach our goal and meet our operating expenses. Please allow KPFK to thrive by pledging at whatever level you're able to at kpfk.org. If you'd rather call in your support, you can do so as well at 818-985-5735. If you're passionate about any of the topics that we regularly focus on here at KPFK, then please make your contribution now. Every contribution is important. Whether it's a single gift at the basic membership level of $25 or monthly installments of $25 or anything in between or beyond. The point is, every listener's contribution is valued. Once more, to make your pledge right now, please go to kpfk.org/donate or call us at 818-985-5735. Thank you for supporting KPFK, your Pacifica radio station.
Join listener-supported KPFK. Call now, 818-985-5735.
This is Quetzal Flores from the band Quetzal, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 Los Angeles.
Welcome to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman. On today's show, we're joined by Emil Dreitzer. He's an author, scholar, former Soviet satirist, and his life story bridges two worlds and two eras. His newest book is called Laughing All the Way to Freedom, The Americanization of a Russian Emigre, and it chronicles his journey from censorship and conformity in the former Soviet Union to the chaotic freedoms he encountered in 1970s America. With wit and unflinching honesty, Emil recounts the culture shock, contradictions, and gradual transformation of becoming American, and not just on paper. It's a story of reinvention told through the eyes of someone who came to this country when immigrants like him were actively welcomed by the U.S. government. But times have changed. In our conversation today, we're going to ask Emil to reflect on that contrast between his own experiences as a Cold War refugee during the Cold War, a Soviet Jew, and the climate faced by immigrants today under an administration increasingly hostile to those seeking a new life on American soil. And we're also going to touch on the new Russian-American friendship between Putin and Trump, imperial autocrats determined to redefine the character of politics, Putin in Ukraine and Trump in the Americas and beyond. We're also going to ask for your support for this program and this station, and we'll offer copies of Emil's book as a thank you gift for your listener sponsorship. All this when our program returns in just a moment. And welcome back to the program. I'm Susie Wiseman, and I'm really happy to have Emil Dreitzer back with us again to discuss his newest book. It's the fourth in his quartet of memoirs. Emil's a Soviet satirist turned American memoirist, and he's here with us to talk about the latest installment called Laughing All the Way to Freedom, his sharp, funny, and poignant account of becoming an American after leaving the Soviet Union. We're going to get his take on the use of satire as both a survival tool and a form of resistance in the Soviet Union, the challenges and revelations encountered during his cultural assimilation into the United States, and the enduring impact of his Soviet experiences on his identity and worldview. Emil often repeats the cliche in his book, you can take the boy out of the country, but you can't take the country out of the boy. And even more, many more apt Soviet statements, and we're going to explore them now. So with all of that, welcome to the program. Emil, I'm so happy to see you again.
Thank you.
And let me just properly introduce you to our listeners. Emil was born in Odessa in Ukraine, and he began his writing career as a freelancer. And then he began doing satire, and we're going to talk about that as well. And then eventually he got into trouble in the Soviet Union for the critical satirical articles that he published and emigrated to the United States in 1975, settling right here in Los Angeles. And soon he became a grad student at UCLA and got his PhD there in Russian literature. And then he became a professor in New York at Hunter College. He's now professor emeritus That's part of the CUNY system. And he's also an award-winning author of artistic and scholarly prose. This book is his 18th. And he's also published many short stories and essays in the LA Times, Partisan Review, North American Review, World Literature Day, Prism International, and so many others. So we're going to talk today about laughing all the way to freedom. So, all right, Emil, with all of that, let's talk about your book. But you begin by talking about before leaving the Soviet Union, and you can tell our listeners when it was, about this sort of inner immigration, the way you prepared yourself mentally to leave physically from the Soviet Union. What was it like having to live a kind of double life in that last period?
It's a very, very good question that I ask myself many times until I realized that actually my writing gradually, my satirical writing, primarily, I was a satirist in the Soviet Union, which my son even says, Dad, isn't it Soviet satirist is a contradiction in terms? I said, and I understand it, of course, but the Soviet system needed satire, but only in limited focus. In other words, you can write about practically many things. However, do not generalize. You can say that the factory number 17 in the city of Frunze produces poor shoes, but you cannot say that the whole system of domestic shoemaking is very bad.
I mean, you talk about it in the book as the Soviet values. I don't know if they're values or just what has, you know, become part of you. They stick to you like a piece of chewing gum. In your book, I think you say that. It's really interesting because as we read the book, we see which aspects of that Soviet mindset are the most difficult to unlearn. And I'd like to go through some of them and even about which parts of that mindset were useful to help you adapt into the United States. It's a huge sort of area to begin with, but maybe you could just say, maybe give us one little example of something that stuck to you like chewing gum.
Well, what stuck to me is, of course, the very principle that the Soviet system had is do not talk about yourself, talk about your community, your collective, and so on. And it's in me. And definitely, I try to avoid talking by myself, even but there are things that I should be joyful about. For example, at the end of this semester, one of my auditors wrote me a letter that saying, wow, it was so, but sending even to a friend, I have to introduce, this is bragging. You see what I mean? You cannot say about your own achievements. This sticks to me.
It's so interesting because you talk about it, you know, it's a sort of self-deprecation, but it's very Soviet. It's also Jewish.
You know? Well, by all means, even my own daughter said, please, this is breaking. I mean,
yeah, no, we don't need to go into that. But one of the things, of course, I've interviewed you many times on your books, and I always treasure how easily you are able to convey what bureaucratic life in the former Soviet Union was just by way of a simple story or even a paragraph or even a sentence, you know. And it's for someone, you know, like myself, who's a longtime student of the Soviet Union, it's incredible to be able to read your work, and not even as satire, but just to see the way that you describe certain things. And I hope that, you know, as we go on today, we'll be able to go through, you know, the way that you see life in the former Soviet Union and the way that you brought that mindset and began to look at life in the U.S. And even the way that you use satire there. I mean, did you find, let's just begin with this, when you came to the U.S., that the old form of satire worked or did not work to approach American life?
Again, as I said before, you cannot say what I said now to you in Soviet publication. But, for example, one of my last publications in Crocodile was about actually bureaucracy, but it has to have concrete names of the people involved, locations, and so on. No, do not generalize. For example, the one piece that opens the book is about the dark copy. Dark copy means some worker, one day he received his salary, and it was much more than usual. He says, well, I'm pleased, of course, but tell me, what for? I mean, what did I do? I mean, in other words, you know, like self-congratulation. And they say, we don't know. You know, there is a Russian proverb, they give you a take. They hit you, run. That's it. So don't ask questions, in other words. So in other words, the human part of that kind of a situation falls out. And then later on, next time, he received, the same man received much less than usual. And again, the people around him wondered, wait a minute. But, and even his wife said, wait a minute, you already paid dues to the union from this salary. How come? I mean, what is it for? They say he came to, again to and said, we don't know. There was a dark copy and therefore we made a mistake. And it's obvious that I come to conclusion and I write about it, that the man who, the big boss in the center who sent this the circular for action, wrote in white, I mean, another good copy and so on, that they then received only dark copy, you know, from a copier, okay? So that therefore he's not guilty, of course, and they are not guilty. So who is guilty? Then the man really got drunk, after all, unable to resolve this situation, and drunk to the extent that he became dark copy, you know.
But in a way, this one really illuminates the sort of way that nobody wants to take responsibility for a mistake, because you can get into a lot of trouble if you do have a mistake and you simply pass the buck. And so nobody's to blame. You know, just if something else happened down the line and it can, you know, as you say, the next paycheck will have less. And it's not about the money anyway.
But and the second thing that I noticed, of course, living in the Soviet Union, the ultra-centralization of everything. Everything has to be confirmed by Moscow. And I described a scene in which I, you know, the narrator, comes to a small town for business and so on. He notices that there is a soccer game should be in the town. So he asked one of the locals who reads paper, tell me, what time is this soccer game? He says, how do I know? There should be a circular coming from Moscow that tells when the soccer game will start, how it will end, who will, and so on and so forth. So that kind of a things that already made me the inner immigrant, since you asked me about it. Even these channels were very close, what really happened, very few people realize it outside of the Soviet Union, that after invasion of Soviet Union on Czechoslovakia, 1968, they decided that in the Literary Gazette, which is read by all intellectual people in Soviet Union, they allowed some kind of a talk about issues that were impossible to find in Pravda, Izvestia, and other, in Aesopian language. And this Aesopian language was like talking about things that intellectual reader would understand what's involved, you know, but there is no direct accusation of it.
I mean, I think that this was the case with not just Soviet literature, but East European literature too, that there was a kind of almost private language between the reader and the writer and the reader, I should say. And that one thing that, of course, we could say about the former Soviet Union, that it was a highly literate society.
That's
and
true.
People always had their head in deep, thick books. And it was this relationship that the reader had with the writer. And I know right after the collapse of the Soviet Union, when commercial values rather than literary values became the norm, it became difficult to write if you're not writing in the Aesopian language. And I think the literature suffered.
If I may continue, at the same time, when I came to America, I missed it. You understand? For me, writing in the Sapien language was a way of creativity. You have to come up with a situation in which people who know realize what's going on.
So you described the way satire helped you and humor helped you cope in a way. And you also describe very deep relationships that you had with other people, even in some ways, your close friends. We'll get to that in a second. But I'm just wondering, like, how that satire was translated into coming to the United States. Was it useful? Did you find that you would say things to people and they had no idea what you were talking about?
Okay, this probably would be my opening of America. First of all, I came on the eve of 1975, literally, December 31st in Los Angeles. And obviously, coming to America was simply, we're not prepared. To come, for example, to supermarkets and see overwhelming amount of all kinds of stuff, it was damaging to the psyche. And I remember, actually, it's a true story about a Soviet pilot, Belenko, who took constructions of Soviet planes and he flew to Japan. No, he escaped the country. Then he was brought to the United States and his caseworker took him back and forth from his hotel. And at one point, caseworker said, you know what, I'm sorry, but I have to stop because my wife told me to buy instant coffee and I keep forgetting. Could you come with me? So the Belenko came with him and they came to the supermarket and the caseworker noticed that after visiting this supermarket, Belenko became angry, locked up himself. And, what is it? Why? What's happening? Well, he said, I don't understand it, Belenko said. I risk my life. I told you so many military secrets and why this show? He could not believe that the regular supermarket is what we see in America in practically every town.
It's what we call Potemkin Village in the Soviet Union. They show off the best, but it isn't.
And they especially put this up in order to convince him to soften up, so to speak, and so on. Okay, to that degree. Yeah, but I have to say that even somebody I knew personally, the mother of one of the immigrants, when it was possible already later on, came to visit her daughter from Russia, from Soviet Union. And she was Communist Party member and so on. And the daughter also, without second thought, just took her to supermarket just, you know, to keep company and so on. And then finally, when she came up and see that kartoshka is washed for selling, she started to cry. She could not bear it because nothing like that she saw in her little town where she comes from. But there were many things that were totally, how to say it, America was not a paradise for us when we arrived because so many attitudes were totally different. Attitude toward business, for example.
This is a good one. Tell the story.
In America, to give somebody, to help somebody is to give him a job. So I had a personal friend, American, and my friend, Cy Fromkin, he ran a small business and he called me. He called me and said, listen, you asked me to help one of the immigrants. I gave them a job and they take long kind of breaks for smoking, for other and so on. They don't understand that in America, you work, you have to work.
And time is money, as they say.
Exactly. It's nobody in the Soviet Union. It was frankly, it was often any opportunity that you can not work hard and escape. For example, at one point in my life, I was working for a research lab. And I noticed that what really happened is that people were not fully charged. In other words, I calculated that probably it was enough of 6 people working for this lab. In reality, 12 worked. You understand? So, for example, if they start in a dinner break, a chess tournament, if there is bosses not around, they continue to the end of the shift and things like that.
So I remember one of the first times that I went while it was still Soviet, that there were lots of people in the streets walking around, and I asked them what they were doing, and they said they were working.
Exactly.
And I was thinking, well, how's that? And of course, what it meant was that they were designated to go out and see if there was anything in the shops that they could get for others. And that was
absolutely,
part of work.
Absolutely. And then, so therefore, since we talk about labor, the official slogan, Soviet labor, is a matter of honor, valor, and heroism. And we came to America. Now I see it, at the end of the day, they bring to a cafe, which is TGF.
And that's what I was going to ask you exactly. Like, that's the next story. TGIF.
Thank God it's Friday. I say, how come? In other words, you openly say that you work hard and now it's a break for you. That's the whole point, that in the Soviet Union, in underground jokes will be, work makes horse die. So in other words, work is for horses, you know, in other words.
They pretend to pay us and we pretend to work was the slogan.
Absolutely, yeah.
So I think I used to say that it was the Soviet workers, they got for themselves a measure of control over their work process, even if it meant they weren't working. And that was sort of like the only thing that was a legacy of the October Revolution in a so-called worker state, where workers really didn't have any control. But they did have control over how they worked. And they worked poorly, and that was fine.
Exactly, yeah.
But then when you came to the U.S. and you talk about this, the work ethic was very different. You did not seem to have so much trouble adapting. Others did, and you talked about being bewildered by this notion of, thank God it's Friday, you know, that you couldn't wait to get through the work week. But you also, you know, talk about first time you saw all these books thrown into the trash. I want you to tell that story. And also, like, just this one other thing that you say in the book, Emil Dreitzer, is that in the Soviet Union, if you lose your job, you say so. You say, I lost my job. And it's a terrible thing. And then they'll tell you everything about how you lost it. But if you come to the U.S., he said, people would not say, I lost my job. They'd say, I'm in between jobs.
Exactly.
Now, of course, I think that there's a level of shame there. People don't want to admit that they were fired.
That's absolutely true.
But it also means that there's not the same level of kind of honesty between people in that regard about their situation in life.
That's true. Americans as people were also in many ways different from Russians. For example, Russians are heartwarming people. However, if you're a foreigner, they may take time to understand what you can say to them, what you can do to them, and things like that. And I found when I came to America that overall, the image of the Americans who are blood-sucking and so on and so forth in Soviet propaganda was not true. Practically everybody was friendly, even to the degree that that made me laugh, of course. I would say, I'm sorry, my English is not so good, obviously, on the first stage. And they would say, your English is better than my Russian, okay? Question comes, why he needs Russian to begin with? He doesn't. And I needed it to work, you know.
But you were talking about that in terms of encountering American optimism, but also in some sense, superficiality as well. So I want to just say that on the times that I go to Russia, and before that, the Soviet Union, I'd be walking down the street and I was trying to just, you know, be anonymous. But it was always obvious that I was American. And I would ask everybody, you know, I don't dress differently than you do much. What is it? What is it? And they finally said, it's because you smile.
Exactly. Because that's the whole point. Smile in America is no more than just simply politeness. But beyond that, there is some kind of a deep sense of self-sustain. I'm okay. I handle my life. I handle all of this and so on. But in Russia, it's only for you save a smile for close relatives and in a more intimate circumstance, of course, you do. But you, by and large, when you get out of in the streets, you want to be anonymous. No, really.
Can you talk, Emil, a little bit about the difference between, you do this just so beautifully in the book, Laughing All the Way to Freedom, that about the difference between a friendship in the Soviet Union and one in the United States. And you give this great example in a party about meeting this guy who seems like, oh, he's going to be my friend. And he's asking me about my personal life. Yeah, do you remember that story? And he turns out he's actually an insurance salesman.
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah.
but tell our listeners what the difference was, you know, sort of the level, because it's really about the superficiality of relations here, even though you say Americans are generous and they're polite and they really want to help, but it only goes so far.
Well, that it took me a while. Basically, oftentimes a close friend in Russia, in Soviet Union, in my time, was more important than one family member, because you had a sense that you have to survive thanks to friends. Friendships means connections. That means you do for this for me, and I'll do this for you, and things like that. You know, that was a kind of a safety net. But in America, there is a clear thing: do not mix friendship with business, because sooner or later one of them will suffer. So therefore, I found even one of my close American friends, when I asked him, I was traveling, I was living for California to see my family, my grandson there. And I asked him to move my car from one side of the street to another side of the street to avoid the ticket, so to speak. And when I came back, I found the ticket. He said, yeah, it's too bad. But yeah, I forgot. In other words, the friendship assumes you run your errands yourself. In the Soviet Union, would be no question he would do that, what I ask. Here, the assumption is that I am self-sustained. This is the condition under which we can have friendship. And we had friendship in American sense. We met for lunches, for dinners. We shared some, you know, personal kind of stories with each other and so on and so forth, but not running your business. You understand?
Yeah, I do. And I think that one thing that comes through in your memoir is how much humor helped you survive this, because a lot of people would find that very alienating and lonely, but you seem to have adapted and, you know, and then wrote funny stories about it. Is that the case?
Well, probably writing funny stories was the solution. See what I mean? I didn't change much, but I say running. That was material from my observed America, of course, when I came. And for example, I could not believe it. I heard on the radio this song, Wonderful World. I don't know much geography. I don't know much algebra, trigonometry, but I love you. And I thought to myself, comparing what I know about dating and the rest of it, that's what he's selling, that he's ignominious, totally. How come? I mean, this is, that's interesting, the ignorance. And then I found that there was an article of my former compatriot, Isaac Asimov, in one of the American magazines, the article he wrote, The Cult of Ignorance. So, but it took time to realize, after all, I went through American educational system and I realized it's inverted pyramid. In other words, the higher you go, I went through it, the more difficult it is, the more responsibility you have to take for what you have done. And that's why in America, universities, graduate programs in leading universities are attracted to students from all over the world.
It's really interesting, because it's exactly as you say. You know, I took my students to the Soviet Union and we went to kindergarten and middle school and high school classes. And they were astonished, first of all, that the kindergartners were already learning English phrases, and asked our students if they'd been to Disneyland. We couldn't imagine American kindergartners asking that of Russian visitors. But not just that. It's just I had a friend whose daughter, he had a year in the U.S. His daughter was in seventh grade. And I said, how do you like school? And she said, well, it's a lot of fun, but it's boring. Because, for example, seventh grade, we're learning algebra. But in Russia, we learned that in fourth grade. So she just used the year to kind of, make friends, right? And to have fun, but not, it was not serious. She thought it was not serious. And I don't know, and I don't know if you know how, if it's changed much now, whether it's that still the same sort of, you know, that education is held very highly. Now we have, you mentioned cult of ignorance. We seem to have the cult of ignorance in power today in the United States. And on the other hand, and they're attacking universities, universities are under assault, research, there's skepticism about science, about everything. And then in Russia, it's a different sort of, you know, forced propaganda that you can't use the word, you know, war. You can only say special military operation, and kids are inculcated with patriotism and military and all of that from preschool. But what about on the other sense? Is there still an emphasis on what we would call the solid subjects, you know, reading, science?
Well, overall, I just recently talked to a woman who for some necessity went back to Moscow for a couple of weeks. She needed to go. And she said that overall, actually, the requirement toward education and the rest of it is less than in the Soviet time, because, as you know, now it's a mixture of oligarchy and dictatorship. You know,
right. So it's exactly.
That was Soviet Union, one way or another, they had to follow the program of creating a new men and women who are educated for the future. In other words, education itself had a high value. Not now, because it's a capitalist society, no matter how you look at it, okay?
But it's a kind of interesting form of it that you get. You know, I wanted to ask you, because this will be one of your perceptions. You talk about attitude to the law of the Soviet immigrants coming to the U.S. Well,
yes.
Certainly you know that growing up in a very repressive society, you try to do everything to avoid the law, right?
Well,
or work around it. I remember one story of a friend of mine who was representing all these new Russian Soviet immigrants here in L.A., and they had a taxi service, and it turned out they didn't have insurance. Most of them didn't have driver's licenses. Because they didn't want to go have any encounter with the bureaucracy.
Of course. Yeah,
and didn't understand it. So tell me about that sort of, you call it, I think, legal nihilism.
I looked up one of the emigre papers and I saw an ad, business marriage proposal. And I thought that, what is it? I thought that merging of two companies, you know, I'm in America a long time, maybe merging two companies together and so on. It says, no, just simply, a man or a woman said that if they come in agreement with about the sum of money, they can, you know, on paper, marry some foreigner to give them an opportunity to come to settle in America and things like that. It's hard to imagine. Even I teach one of my classes that I teach is Russian cinema and society. And I show actually students starting from Ivan the Terrible time, basically. The law, it was, we say it in Russian, закон как дышло, куда повернешь, туда и вышло. In other words, nobody took a law seriously. And it is clear, because once you have a dictatorship, there is no need to go to the books, because it's all phone call from above to the judge to say how many years of prison this man deserves. Or, you know, things like that. In the Soviet Union,
It's a really important observation, Emil Droitzer, because you talk about the Tsarist past to the Soviet period and what you saw there, of course, and during Stalin, you could be whisked into a labor camp, a death camp. The charges were absolutely bizarre and absurd. Well, but I wanted you to just, you know, take a moment to reflect about what's happening today, because now you have, it's not just that sort of legal, I think you called it cynicism. I have a friend, Kagarlitsky, who's in jail for making a joke about the cat on the Mostak, the cat on the bridge to Crimea, and he's serving, you know, 4 years for justifying terrorism. And another person puts a line from a poem on Pushkin on a monument, and she's arrested and now serving 2 years for somehow making an anti-war statement, which of course she was. But these charges are absolutely absurd today, just as they were before, but very different regime. And I wondered, you know, like, is this an echo from the old system that you see, or just an excuse to crack down on dissent that's been forever? How do you see it?
Well, I think that quite openly, Putin said that he admires Stalin's time. Moreover, since I teach cinema, I found that there was produced a movie. I think the title is called like Rest Area Back to the Soviet Union. In other words, it's like a park in which actually it's glorified the time of Stalin. You understand? How can you glorify from our normal point of view? But it was a glorified. So there is no question in my time that I'm not surprised. In other words, the accusation of given sentences for a wrong word and so on. One of my books, as I remember you interviewed me, it's a biography of Soviet Romeo spy, you know, Stalin's Romeo spy. And he told me, now I talk to eyewitness, okay, he told me that in the 30s, he remembers it was enough. If you like the apartment of your neighbor, you just said that he listens to foreign radio. That's it, enough. No, there's no need to prove anything. You understand? That's horrible. Or you like his girlfriend to begin with. So you remove him once and for all. And that was somebody who was there. I mean, he lived that way. And he himself, I'm just putting 16 years he spent in Gulag, despite all his achievements as a spy in the West. Yeah.
All of this goes back to talking about, I guess, sort of the continuation of certain parts of the Soviet Union, but you're talking about your own Americanization. You've now been in the U.S. for like, what, 50 years? And these memoirs really are quite wonderful. And this one kind of shows you this is, you know, this long road to Americanization. And the question, I guess, is do you now feel at home in America, or do you still feel like a visitor with a suitcase?
No. I definitely don't feel like a visitor with a suitcase, but there are certain aspects of American life that still amuse me. For example, I put it in the book, the episode, I had a friend who lived in opposite side of the country in Southern California. And we talked on the phone, and then all of a sudden his voice broke and I felt that something really happened to him. So I called our mutual American friend, and she said, wait a minute, I want to be sure that his address is the same as I have. So we compared that. So I said, why address? He said, well, I'll call local police. I said myself, my God, why you call police? But police was avoided by all means in the Soviet Union. But here she saw it's a wellness check. They call and they will perform. I had no opportunity, thank God, so far to have a wellness check. So this was the first time. And yet the police came, come to the manager. The manager he rented apartment in the building and found him on the floor without consciousness. He had some kind of a problem. So they called the ambulance and ambulance took him to hospital, and he was brought back to life. I say, but I was really shocked. I could not. What I realized that exactly what you started the interview with. I came first time in America when I hear that some of the social workers who worked with us newcomers from the Soviet Union said, "You can take a Jew out of the Soviet Union." But it's not that easy to take Soviet Union out of Soviet Jew. You understand?
Yeah, of course. And I think you make the observation in your book, too, after telling this story about the wellness check, that you just couldn't believe that, you know, police were not to be avoided. But then you say, but if you're black or brown in the U.S., it's the same. It's the same idea.
Exactly. Illustration to that. Vast majority, you won't be surprised, majority of Soviet immigrants from Soviet Union voted Trump.
And this is, you know, this is, you know, I've always, you know, wondered about this. And I always thought, well, it's the legacy of Stalinism.
Exactly.
That it's, you know, that it is just this society was so unlivable and horrific in so many ways that people don't want to trust anybody that is in the least left wing. I think that's changing slightly now. What I wanted to ask you, because we mentioned it in the beginning, that you belong to, you know, a set of immigrants, the Soviet refuseniks, they were called, or just Soviet, you know, Soviet Jews, and you were welcomed here. And it was part of the Cold War. It had a lot of propaganda value for the United States, but you were a beneficiary. And today's immigrants, you know, are not in the same boat. And as you were talking about that, you know, if you know right now this policy of Trump to deport all the immigrants, they have ICE going door to door or business to business and rounding up people, no due process, all of that. And I wonder, because you talk so much about, you know, Americanizing yourself in a way, acculturating to America, does this shock you in a way that's, you know, almost incomprehensible?
Absolutely shocked, because in my time, America was the country of immigrants, the Statue of Liberty with, you know, welcoming you and all of this. So I couldn't even think that at one point America will come to the point that immigrants would be not welcome. I understood that the strength of America is based on the new fresh blood. You understand that even a few people back in the Soviet Union did not want to go into trouble of picking up everything and destroy their present life and go to America to know what, because we basically like jump into the precipice, you know. So why? Because the kind of people who came to America means that they have the extra energy that they cannot use in their own country. You understand? So America benefits on this extra willingness to succeed, willingness to do something. You understand? That's what it is. Yeah. To me, this is hard to imagine. I often say to my friends, America today is not America I came 50 years ago, from one of the examples of it. Yeah.
I think probably the question, and it's not one that I expect any of us can really answer, is whether or not this is short-lived and it can bounce back in any way, or if there's a permanent damage at this point. There's certainly going to be economic damage by getting rid of people who are the actual workers in the country.
It's hard for me. First of all, I'm a foreigner, but when I still a foreigner, in other words, I talk to my friends. I have a few American friends. And they bring to my attention the following. It said, it may be not forever, but there have been dark parts in American history. Let's say America of the 30s. It's not America you will be proud of. America who didn't want to get involved in the war, didn't want to give refuge to Jewish refugees coming and so on. And many, many awful things that Hitler had in his plan, he took it from some American of the late 20s and so on. Somebody told me that one of the American presidents welcomed Ku Klux Klan chief in his office. And here it is, what I'm trying to say, that this is not the only dark period in America. So hopefully we live through and it will come better. I think that from what I see now, so many people totally agree with me. They to the degree that, okay, some of them say simply depressed.
I think that's absolutely true. And people need to have a moment of peace in a way from all the chaos.
Right.
But of course, we have to be incredibly vigilant. Emil Dreitzer, I want to thank you so much. And I'm just, as we're talking, recalling all the books that we talked about here that form the quartet, as I'm calling it. I don't know if you call it a quartet, of your memoirs. But this book we're going to be offering as a thank you gift for those who pledge their support to KPFK and to this show. And the book is Laughing All the Way to Freedom. And once you read it, I think you're going to want to go back and read several of the other ones. And I was just trying to look to see if I have all the titles in front of me. One of them is Shush, Growing Up Jewish in Soviet. Tell me the full title.
Maybe can I comment on this?
Yes.
The reason why I'm optimistic, like, because this particular book, my first memoir book, Shush, Growing Up Jewish Under Stalin, is now, according to the world catalog, is in over 1,600 libraries of the world.
Brilliant.
So,
I want to tell the listeners to go and get this book. There's so much we couldn't touch on that you're going to laugh out loud, as I did. Some of the stories that are in this memoir are perplexing, like the one called Disappearance, where I'm assuming you're talking about your own disappearance in American life. It's a great little story. We don't have time to go into it right now, but it's just chock full of many, many different stories, laughing all the way to freedom. And it recalls some of, the jokes from one of the first books I read of yours, Forbidden Laughter, Soviet Underground Humor, which even got you a spot on the Merv Griffin Show. And yes, that's something that our listeners are going to have to just pick up the book to read. But I want to thank you so much for all your writing and all your work, Emil Dreitzer. We're going to still have you back because I know you're not stopping.
my next book is in the reading. It's called Chekhov in Brighton Beach.
Well, I want to thank you once again, Emil Dreitzer, and once again tell our listeners that they ought to pick up this book. You'll learn a lot, not only about the former Soviet Union, but especially about what it's like to encounter American with such a completely different background. And it's very humorous throughout. I found myself laughing a lot and learning a lot. I think you will as well. So thank you. Thank you so much, Emil, and we look forward to talking to you again.
Yeah, thank you. I hope so.
Welcome back to Beneath the Surface. I'm Susie Wiseman, joined by Alan Minsky. He's the executive director of the Progressive Democrats for America, and he used to be, as you all know, program director at KPFK. And we're here to ask for your support for this program and for this station. KPFK is in the last days of its fund drive, and we have a lot to thank you for. But first of all, we want to thank you for picking up the phone right now at 818-985-5735 and pledging your support and your sponsorship for this program and for this radio station. We do have a nice thank you gift for you today. We just finished speaking with Emil Dreitzer. He's been on the show, I think, just about after every one of his books. Not quite, but it's certainly his memoirs and his book on Soviet spy. But this one is Laughing All the Way to Freedom. And we're able to offer that to you as a thank you gift today if you pledge your support right now. 818-985-5735. And for $125, you not only become a listener sponsor, but you also get a copy of this book, Laughing All the Way to Freedom, The Americanization of a Russian Emigre. Alan?
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, and the thing here, folks, is what a great thank you gift. I mean, very distinctive, very memorable. You will pick that up and pledge support to KPFK, and you'll always remember with this book that you're supporting Susie Weissman's great show that has been on KPFK for most of the history of the station, but not all of it. It's an incredible show, incredible longevity, loved by people across Southern California. And of course, it is here over the airwaves of Southern California only because you support the station. It is so distinctive, it's so powerful in its analysis of the world. There is simply no media project in the country that has its finger on the pulse of the danger of the Trump administration. Why is that? Because there is simply no show in the country that has as deep an understanding of the roots of Putinism and what Vladimir Putin is all about and how he has managed to consolidate power in the post-Soviet era. And, you know, nowadays, not working at KPFK anymore, I work following every day's news around the consolidation of a fascist, proto-fascist power here in the United States by the Trump administration. And the model is so directly related to the model of Putin. And for those people who think, well, you know, America has this long history of democracy, this is such a different country than post-Soviet Russia. Once Trump comes into his second term, in coordination with the richest people the world has ever known, the oligarchs of Silicon Valley, then the model of buying up the media, shutting down free speech, becomes available to him as a prospect, and he is pursuing it. TikTok, for instance. Yeah. Could be
Alan,
bought,
I just want to say that. Thank you for all of that. I want to just say that, you know, Trump admires and loves Putin because Putin was able to turn political power into great wealth. And it's not a question of wealth into power, but power into wealth, more wealth. And we see, of course, Trump and his family are enriching themselves unconstitutionally in incredible ways and bringing in the likes of Elon Musk, South African. And it's all of that, you know, is sort of borrowed in a way on the copy of Putin. Putinism as a kind of new form of fascization, not quite fascism, but something very close. Patrimonial state, mafia state, all of that. When you read deeply or hear more about it, you'll get so many echoes from Putin. I just want to quickly say, Alan, Emil Dreitzer came here in the 70s at the height of the Cold War at a moment when Soviet Jews were being allowed out of the country. He had already fallen into discord with the regime because of his political satire. But his own experience could not be replicated today. The refugees in the 70s were welcomed. But today, immigrants are not only faced by an increasingly hostile climate, but are also just not being let in or being whisked away. So there's a real contrast there, and it's really interesting to hear Emil speak about it. And you can look at his experience, and I know as you read his book, you will laugh a lot because he hasn't lost his sense of irony and his incredible satire. The book's called Laughing All the Way to Freedom. And we're offering it to you today for just $125. And when you call in at 818-985-5735 and pledge your support, you get that book, but you also are pledging your support to keep this radio on the air.
818-985-5735. But most importantly, you're keeping Beneath the Surface with Suzy Weissman on the air. And that is so important to get the information you need to understand the political moment we're living in right now. And again, the model of Putin, Trump's relationship to that model, especially now with the Silicon Valley oligarchs at his side, the very people, the probably only group of people in the world rich enough to buy and effectively achieve a consolidation of American media. We're talking about he's lining up someone to buy TikTok. He's lining up someone to buy CBS from that crowd, folks, as it goes on sale. So we need this radio show. We need Pacifica Radio as the antidote to that. And it only happens with your support, folks. So call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, and pledge whatever you can. What's most important is that we have Suzy and her work and her insights and the insights of her guests over the airwaves of Southern California going forward. This strike a blow for free speech, strike a blow for this remaining an open society, one that is a democracy, folks. And you can do that by calling 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. $125 pledge of support. We will send you Emil Draper's book as a thank you gift. But if you pledge at the $50 level, at the $75 level, at the $750 level, pledge whatever you can, folks. Support Background Briefing. Sorry. Scratch that. Support Beneath the Surface with Suzy Weissman. Call now. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK.
And I have to say, Alan, thank you for that. Times have really changed, and I've been bringing to the listeners the whole story of the Soviet Union when this program was called Portraits of the USSR and then the New World Disorder and the whole disintegration of the Soviet Union. I never imagined that we would have a president like Trump who has recreated or has created anew a Russian-American friendship that is a friendship between two imperial autocrats who are determined to redefine the character of politics and to redefine geography. Trump, so-called erasing the line between the U.S. and Canada, and Putin in Ukraine and beyond. And it's really quite astonishing, but I pledge to you, the listener, that I will be bringing you more and more analysis of that so that you can understand the so-called architecture of the new security apparatus throughout the world now that Trump has allied himself, at least for the moment, because we know Trump doesn't stick to anything, only to what is in his immediate interest. Call in right now at 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, and please pledge your support. For $125, you get this great book that I guarantee you will be a distraction, and you'll laugh, and you'll appreciate satire once again. Laughing All the Way to Freedom is yours for just $125. And as Alan said, for $50, $75, $100, $500, you can become a sponsorship of this kind of radio, 818-985-5735, or go to kpfk.org. Do it online. Alan?
818-985-5735. I love what you just said about satire. You know, it does really take for a great work of satire right now. It's probably pretty much easier to step away from our current reality. Recently, somebody put up a meme which showed some ostensibly like witches at a coven trying to they claimed they were the staff of the Onion trying to conjure up jokes that were more absurd than the present reality. So satire can be difficult in a time of crisis like this, especially absurd crisis with Trump. But Emile Dreitzer is, of course, a brilliant satirist. And you'll love this book as a thank you gift when you call 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. But most importantly, you get Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. So important, Sunday morning, over the airwaves, free for all the people of Southern California, but it only is because of your donations that we're able to keep it that way, folks. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Back to you, Susie. Keep those phone calls coming.
Thank you, Alan, and thanks for joining us. And we'll just finish up today by asking you all seriously to pledge your support. KPFK is always in a financial crisis, but right now it's critical that all media is in crisis, and of course broadcast media above all. So we want you to call in your support and make sure that this station stays on the air and that this program stays on the air so that we can bring you the kind of analysis, understanding, and just information. And I won't say that you can't get it anywhere else, but you get it consistently here. And we try very hard because we understand that you cannot be effective participants in the society in which you live unless you're armed with the kind of information that helps you separate, conspiracy thinking from fact, all of it in every single field. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK, or kpfk.org. Pledge your support. For $125 today, you can pick up this great book, a memoir, The Americanization of a Russian Emigre, called Laughing All the Way to Freedom. It tells his stories back in Russia that got him in trouble when it was the Soviet Union. And he continues those stories here. And some of it is really hilarious when he talks about trying to understand American friendship, American dating, American attitude to work. And you'll recognize a lot of it, and you too will chuckle. And as I said at the outset, this might be a bit of a distraction, but also will hit home in some of the more important ways that we need to understand about the former Soviet Union, Russia today, and the United States. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Pledge your support. Keep us on the air. And I want to thank you all so much for your support in the past and hope that I can count on you for your support in the future. Keep KPFK on the air, keep Beneath the Surface. It's been around for a very long time, as Alan said. I'm not that ancient, but somehow I guess I started when I was five. 818-985-5735, 818-985-KPFK. Pledge your support, and thank you so much for listening. That's our show for today. I'd like to thank my guest, Emile Dreitzer. Thanks to executive producer Robert Brentner, producer-director Melissa Figueroa, editor-engineer Juliana Gota, and Osmi Flamenco in Master Control. You can listen to this and other archive shows as well as subscribe to the podcast at kpfk.org. Click Audio Archives and scroll down to Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. And more information on our programs and guests are on our Facebook page, again, Beneath the Surface with Susie Weissman. And you can also listen to an extended version of this program on Jacobin Radio, available wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you've been listening to Beneath the Surface on KPFK, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond, streaming live and archived at kpfk.org. Thanks for listening, and please call in your support for this station and this show at 818-985-5735. 985-5735 or at kpfk.org. All your contributions are really appreciated. Stay tuned now for Ian Masters and Background Briefing. I'm Susie Wiseman.
LA Theater Works airs here on KPFK every Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. Coming up tonight,
a young woman fears she's inherited her father's genius and his debilitating mental illness.
You think...
You have so much talent.
You think I'm like Dad.
You have some of his talent and some of his tendency toward instability.
Anne Heche, Robert Foxworth,